Hello and welcome. It is Eric Erickson here. Delighted to have you with me today. It is Monday. I hope you had a great weekend. I did. It was fried shrimp tacos with the bourbon and cigars last night. Although I had a 1926 Padron, which was a deeply dark and spicy cigar. Maybe a little too strong for me. We'll see. I may try it again. Nonetheless, the phone number, if you'd like to be a part of the program, 877-97-ERIC, 877-973-7425. I want to begin with what was a local crime story and has become a national news item. And I've talked about the story a couple of times. This is the killing of Gene Siller. He is the was the golf pro at a country club in Georgia, Pine Tree Country Club. And I got to read you, they have made an arrest in the murder. And I need to read you the story, parts of it, from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, because it relates to a larger national story. And follow along with me here. The murder suspect is Brian Anthony Roden, 23 years old. Now listen to this. He spent 3 days in jail in 2016 after being charged in a shooting at Georgia State University, where he was an 18-year-old student at the time. A 19-year-old was shot 3 times with Roden's Glock 40, and Roden was shot once in the chest following an attempted drug transaction. In January 2020, Roden punched one officer with the Atlanta Police Department's Airport Drug Interdiction Unit and elbowed another. He was charged 2 days later in Clayton County, which has jurisdiction at Hartsfield-Jackson International Airport, with simple battery on police and obstructing an officer. He was released on $7,500 bond and entered a not guilty plea in August. The case is still pending. Less than 4 months later, Roden was arrested after Atlanta police found 44 marijuana joints and $3,000 in cash in his bag during a traffic stop, according to an incident report. He was arrested in Indiana in August 2020 after leading state troopers on a high-speed chase following an attempted traffic stop. He was arrested twice in the past 11 days, the final time on charges stemming from the 3 murders. Hours after the golf club shootings, he was arrested on traffic charges in Chamblee, records show. He was booked into the DeKalb County Jail on misdemeanor count of DUI, a headlight violation, fake ID, driving without insurance, driving an unregistered vehicle, and using a license plate to conceal the identity of a vehicle. Roden had been stopped about 11:30 p.m. July 3rd while driving a black Maserati with a temporary tag in the 5,000 block of Peachtree Boulevard at a DeKalb County warrant shows. Officers made the stop because the car was missing a headlight and a taillight. During the stop, police found a temporary tag did not match the car's VIN number or the vehicle's registration, which had expired in June of 2020, and Roden was driving without proof of insurance. He was carrying altered driver's licenses from Georgia and South Carolina, each of which bore his photo with someone else's name. He was released on bond Tuesday evening, then arrested again on Thursday after authorities lured him back to the police station under the guise of returning money seized during the traffic stop. Following a brief hearing on Friday evening, Roden is now held without bond. He faces 3 counts of murder, 3 counts of aggravated assault, and 2 counts of kidnapping. Why was he out? Why was he out? This, I'm going to offend some of you. I think we've swung the pendulum back too far as a society. the presumption for too many people now. I mean, let's go to the situation with the Moors. Remember this in Massachusetts over the 4th of July weekend, I believe it was? A group of heavily armed black men were pulled over by police, tied up I-95, the interstate, and the social media reaction from social justice warriors is, well, they must be white. They'd already be gunned down by the police if they were black. Turns out they were black. They were a group of men called, they called themselves Moors, said they were unaffiliated with any country. They were a separatist movement. They said they were nonviolent, peace-loving, but they had a pile of weapons. Why wasn't this guy in prison? Why wasn't Brian Roden in prison? Again, he spent 3 days in jail in 2016 after being charged in a shooting at Georgia State University, where he was an 18-year-old student at the time. A 19-year-old was shot 3 times with Roden's Glock 40. Roden was shot once in the chest following an attempted drug transaction. The Fulton County District Attorney at the time, Paul Howard, did not pursue charges. In January 2020, Roden punched an officer of the Atlanta Police Department's Airport Drug Interdiction Unit and elbowed another. He was charged 2 days later with simple battery on police. Was let out of jail on bond. Charges still pending. Case still pending. Less than 4 months later, he was arrested after Atlanta police found 44 marijuana joints and $3,000 in cash in his bag during a traffic stop. He was arrested in Indiana in August of 2020 after leading police on a high-speed chase. He was arrested twice in the past 11 days. How many of these police officers, how many of these local district attorneys, how many of these prosecutors, how many of these local communities have decided, well, we're just not going to keep people in jail anymore? The jails are overcrowded. COVID's going around. He's a problem young black male. We don't want to look like we're racist. Let's let him go. And ultimately, he wound up murdering 3 people. Allegedly, he murdered 3 people. We got a problem, and the problem is not the problem is a crime problem, but it is also an enforcement problem. You have a lot of jurisdictions now because marijuana is becoming legal in so many places so rapidly. A lot of places are just not prosecuting any sort of crime related to drugs. That's just marijuana. But a lot of police officers will tell you it's not racial profiling. It is criminal pattern profiling. Let me get you again this. He was stopped at 11:30 p.m. July 3rd, driving a black Maserati. Why am I saying Maserati? Maserati with a temporary tag. Officers made the stop because the car was missing a headlight and a taillight, according to the warrant. During the stop, police found a temporary tag didn't match the car's VIN number. The vehicle registration had expired in 2020. He was driving without proof of insurance. He was carrying altered driver's licenses from Georgia and South Carolina, which all bore his photo and someone else's ID. He had a record. He had a long laundry list record of things. Why was he out of jail? He was out of jail because a prosecutor, when he shot someone a couple of years ago, decided not to prosecute. Now, for perspective, the district attorney who chose not to prosecute this guy several years ago, just a few months ago, decided to prosecute a police officer for shooting a man who tried to fire a taser at the officer after having given the other officer a concussion at an arrest. That's right. Garrett Rolfe, police officer. He and another officer pulled over, Rashard Brooks, who fell asleep drunk in a Wendy's drive-thru. They got him calmed down. They were with him for about an hour. They had to take him in. When they announced they were going to take him in, he had other charges. He would go back to jail if they took him in. He fought them, shoved one to the ground so hard he gave him a concussion, took the guy's taser, began to run. Rolfe pursued. The guy turned around, fired his taser at Rolfe. Rolfe opened fire and killed the guy. That's what his training said to do. You're thinking, well, it was a taser. You should have used a taser. You're trained to shoot. You're trained to shoot because if Brooks had incapacitated the officer, could have gotten the officer's gun. He already showed himself to be violent. He gave the other guy a concussion. You're going to second guess it? You're going to armchair quarterback it? But we're seeing this around the country. We've overcorrected. The left started screaming, we're going too hard on young black men. We're going too hard on them. How much of that played a role in lack of prosecution, lack of prison time, lack of jail for this guy? He was clearly headed somewhere bad. His crimes kept escalating. He's got fake IDs. He's got lots of drugs. He's already been involved in a shooting where he himself got shot. He went on a police chase. He shoved and elbowed and punched police officers. There was something evil brewing in this guy all along. And you can say, Erickson, you're armchair quarterback in this. Yeah, you're damn right I am. But there's a pattern there. There's a pattern. And yet too often when these patterns come up now, we got a bunch of progressives saying, oh, you're being racist. It's systemic racism. It's an unfalsifiable claim, systemic racism. I wrote a piece. We'll get into it here in a little while. I don't believe there's systemic racism in the country. And somebody responded, how can you say there's no systemic racism in this country? It's like there was a time in this country when there was systemic racism. There was a time in this country when there was systemic racism, when slavery was legal. And then after the Civil War, in Reconstruction, during the Jim Crow era, entire systems of laws were put in place to make it very, very difficult for black people to get jobs, own land, or vote. And guess what? We don't have those systems anymore. And to the extent that you say we do, to the extent that you say now, that now we are systemically racist, even now we have these problems. How did Barack Obama get elected? How did Kamala Harris get elected? How did Tim Scott, a black man from South Carolina, get elected to represent the birthplace of the Confederacy, where the first shots of the Civil War were fired, if we've got systemic racism? But you just say it and you say it's true. And then you look at young black men getting arrested for crimes. It's like, you got to go easy on them. You go easy on the white guy. Why didn't anyone go easy on this guy at all? The system failed. And three men are murdered because this guy never had a comeuppance. This guy never had to face it. I just, one more time, this is one single paragraph in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Brian Anthony Roden, 23, spent 3 days in jail in 2016 after being charged in a shooting at Georgia State University, where he was an 18-year-old student at the time. A 19-year-old was shot 3 times with Roden's Glock 40, and Roden was shot once in the chest following an attempted drug transaction, authorities said at the time. Then Fulton County District Attorney Paul Howard did not pursue charges against either party involved. Jeff DeSantis, spokesman for the current district attorney, Fannie Willis, said this week he didn't know why the charges weren't pursued. That was 2016. And he's got a record that gets more and more aggressive against law enforcement, against the police, against other people, running all the way up to a shooting at a golf course where an innocent man was killed who leaves behind a wife and children, all because a system failed to prosecute, a system failed to get tough. And I'm sure there are a lot of people smugly out there thanking the system for never having cracked down on Brian Roden. How many people's lives could have been spared had they bothered to crack down? The phone number is 877-973-7425. I got to laugh at this story. This is kind of funny. Texas Democrats to flee state in effort to block GOP-backed voting restrictions. With Republican-backed voting bills moving rapidly through a special session of the Texas state legislature, Democrats in Texas are planning to make a break for it again At least 58 Democratic members of the state House of Representatives are expected to bolt from Austin on Monday in an effort to block the measure from advancing, a source familiar with the plans told NBC News. The unusual move, akin to what they did in 2003 during a redistricting fight, would paralyze the chamber, stopping business until the lawmakers return. The Texas Constitution requires a two-thirds of lawmakers to be present to conduct state business in either chamber. Absent lawmakers can be legally compelled to return to the Capitol. Undoubtedly, the Texas Department of Public Safety is going to have to get involved. You know what they're doing? They've rented charter planes, and they're going to fly to Washington under the advice of Beto O'Rourke to demand voting rights passage in Washington. So they're going to flee their state and not put up a fight so that they can go grandstand in Washington, D.C. They're going to obstruct democracy to try to save democracy. That's how they're going to do it. You know what's going to happen? I can tell you exactly what's going to happen. Redistricting is coming to Texas. Texas is getting a congressional seat. You and I both know darn well the Republicans are going to use this as a negotiating tactic, and they're going to persuade just enough Democrats to come back by giving them comfortable seats and betraying their friends in the Democratic caucus. You know it, and I know it. This is what's going to happen. The Democrats are going to stab themselves in the back. But, yeah, I mean, the pompous nature of this, though, good gracious, what they're going to do is tell the Democrats that they're going to go to Washington and tell the Democrats in Washington, pass the voting rights reform, the John Lewis voting rights bill. Maybe some of them want the For the People Act. We want the For the People Act. That is dead on arrival. The media is so busy blaming Republicans for this stuff, they can't even comment on the fact that Democrats don't have enough Democratic votes. They're all hiding behind Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema when the reality is there are a handful of other Democrats who don't support the legislation. And you don't get that coverage because the media is so broken, so in the mood of blaming Republicans for everything, you don't actually get a complete picture of what's actually going on. As a result, these Democrats really think they can go make a difference in Washington, D.C. They really think they can. And so what's going to happen? They're going to wind up getting arrested and forced to go back to the Texas state capitol under duress where they can grandstand. The media will give them a favorable show of it, but I want to focus on one other aspect here. Republicans are constantly blamed for not accepting democracy. Republicans are constantly blamed for failing to adhere to democracy, democratic norms and standards. The Democrats in Texas, in the Texas legislature, have just deprived the Texas legislature of the ability to meet democratically. And NBC News and other media outlets are rushing out to declare them heroes. Can you imagine if the Republicans had done this? Can you imagine the Republicans? Can it just how they would react? Can you imagine the hypocrisy that the media would go through is astonishing. Democrats having fled on chartered jets. What about the global warming? What's the carbon footprint of flying to Washington and blathering on about a piece of legislation that has no chance of passing? It does make you wonder about the democratic norms. When we come back, well, we'll talk about critical race theory. It is Eric Erickson here. This hour of the program brought to you by First Liberty Building and Loan. FirstLibertyGA.com is their website. If you are in charge of the finances for a big business and want to get it bigger and need a loan to do so, go to First Liberty Building and Loan. FirstLibertyGA.com is their website. Spend 10 minutes with them. See if you're a good fit. FirstLibertyGA.com. Robin Walensky is a reporter in Atlanta at WSB Radio, my flagship station, who is at the funeral for Gene Siller. Gene Stiller is the golf pro who was killed. Brian Roden, as was just talking about in the last half hour, is the suspect here. And I wanted to get Robin on the phone and talk for just a moment. Let's see here if I can pull her up. Robin, welcome to the program. How are you?
Hey, Eric. How are you?
Great. Listen, thanks very much for doing this. I know there's a little bit of a delay. Hang on a second. Let me make sure I've got you properly routed here, because there we go. All right. Now I know I've got you properly routed so folks can hear you, instead of going over the speaker in the studio. Can you kind of set the scene for us here at Gene Stiller's funeral? And I assume there's a large crowd.
Yeah, there's about 1,000 people. It was private. And so we're not getting into, you know, everything that went on the inside. Needless to say, it was absolutely heartbreaking. You have 1,000 people, a huge family that he had, his wife, the two sons, his parents in town from Ohio, and hundreds of people from the country club in attendance, along with officers who were in plain clothes that were there, people who have worked on this case tirelessly, Eric. And I'll tell you, there's a lot of outstanding questions. We do have Brian Roden, the suspect who's charged with the murder, behind bars. But I heard you earlier in your segment, you know, who are some of the enablers around him? Who picked him up on the 10th hole in the woods in Kennesaw? Who bailed him out of jail the first time when he got out? Police had him in custody on July 4th in the wee hours, driving around with no license plate. A total of six misdemeanors, no headlight. Who bailed him out of jail? And then they lured him back with the ruse that they had his money. Hey, come and get your cash. There's a lot of outstanding questions here. Also, in terms of the investigation itself, Eric, who is Henry Valdez, the 46-year-old from Anaheim, California, who was dead in the back of the truck? Who is Mr. Paul Pearson, 76, from Topeka, Kansas, who owned the truck? And what is the connection to this man? Were they buying drugs from him? How did he encounter them? And, you know, of all the crime cases I've covered over the last three decades, Eric, I will just tell you this, that the only thing that rings a bell to me, that rings true in my mind covering crime, is, was this guy going across the country like Andrew Cunanan, who was the murderer of Versace, where he was going from place A to place B and kidnapping and killing and taking a car and then driving to the next spot? I mean, is that what this is about? Does this have to do with drugs? I mean, there are many, many outstanding questions.
So in your experience covering these things, how likely do you think it will be that we're actually going to get answers to a lot of these questions? Because there are so many unknowns here, even going back to some of his prior cases where the guy's got a laundry list of things, from police chases to assaulting police officers and kept getting out of jail, supposedly making a rap album, an aspiring artist, allegedly. And there seemed to be a lot of connections here that, I mean, are we going to be able to get a fuller picture, you think?
I mean, I think if there's pressure from the news media and people are asking the right questions of the Cobb County detectives, who have really kept this thing close to the vest. I mean, I understand that there's an investigation going on. Obviously, U.S. Marshals were involved. Now you have federal agents that are involved, because was he going across state lines? He's originally from Florida. It's a great question. I think if the pressure is kept up by the family and by the news media, we might get some answers. But I think that there's a group of people, the system has enabled him, and there are a group of people around him in his universe, family or friends, that have also enabled him. Anyone who picked him up, you know, after the crime was committed, when he shot Gene Stiller in the head, there was if you know that area of Kennesaw, Eric, there was nowhere for him to go. There was the lake in front of him, the crime scene to his right. He could only go to the left into the woods. And who picked him up on the other side of the woods near I-75? I'd love to know. I would love to know who bailed him out of jail the first time. You know, here the authorities had this guy in custody, and somebody paid that bond, and he got out on the six misdemeanors. So I think that there's enabling by the system. There's enabling by his inner circle. And I don't think he's going to be getting out this time on the three murder charges and the two kidnapping, one would hope.
Now, let me ask you one more question before we let you go. And this is one of the things that absolutely fascinates me. The level of hush-hushness from the Cobb County Police as they pursued this and made an arrest without a lot of leaking, without a lot of tip-offs to the media. There's just suddenly a news story. They've got an arrest, and I find it remarkable in this day and age that they were able to keep it as quiet as they did.
My gut tells me that they were embarrassed that they had the guy in custody and didn't connect the dots.
Uh-huh.
And perhaps they were waiting for the and again, this is just, I mean, I love the police. I work with the police. I respect the police. You know, I have tons of friends that are in the FBI and law enforcement, as I know you do too, Eric. But in this specific case, and I'm not saying that this is a fact, but I'm saying it could be that maybe they were embarrassed. Oh, wow, we had this guy. We let him go. And now we're waiting on maybe the fingerprint evidence from the wheel of the vehicle, from the white truck that was stuck. Maybe it wasn't back yet. And then ding, 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 they get the fingerprint evidence. They just had booked this guy Saturday night into Sunday in the wee hours. And now you have a match on the print. And then, oh, how do we get him back here in custody without some sort of further shootout? And, oh, so we're going to come up with this ruse that his money is here. Apparently there was a lot of cash on him at the time that was taken. And, oh, Mr. Brian, you can come back now and get your cash. And then so they arrested him quietly the second time. I mean, that's the only thing that comes to my mind, Eric.
It's going to continue to be fascinating for some time. Listen, Robin, thank you very much for stopping by and checking in with us. Just keep us informed. This is such a wild story that just making national headlines all over the place.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Robin Walensky, she is at the funeral for Gene Stiller in Kennesaw, the golf pro who was murdered by this guy, Brian Roden. I guess technically we're supposed to say allegedly. One of the interesting angles here, and I wasn't even going to talk about this topic, but this gets to something that Robin was saying, is who is helping him and what are the ties here. He had in the back of this truck the dead body of a man from Anaheim, California, and an elderly gentleman from Topeka, Kansas, who actually owned the truck. We don't know a lot about this. What we do know, and police are talking about more and more regularly now, is the legal and illegal selling of marijuana and other drugs in states where marijuana is legal. And this guy apparently had repeatedly caught with massive supplies of marijuana on him. What is happening more and more is various outlets, often cartel funded, are hiring people. Let me step back a little bit. And again, I want to be very open and honest. This is all speculation, but I know this pattern and practice is happening, having talked to a lot of people in law enforcement. I don't know if you guys heard last week, the drug cartels were busted in Southern California with massive marijuana farms, illegal marijuana farms. Now you're thinking, well, marijuana is legal. Why were they busted? Well, to have a marijuana farm in California that is legal, there's all sorts of regulation, and you got to go through lots of hoops and hurdles, but also there are compliance issues that you have to deal with. So with the sale of marijuana in California, the illegal marijuana selling is still going on. There are a lot of shops in California that aren't licensed the way they're supposed to be. They're buying not just from the licensed dealers, but the illegal people, but then also the illegal marijuana trade with the cartels growing now in California. People are turning a blind eye to them because they think that they're legal. They don't bother to check on licensing. And what they're doing more and more is there are a lot of people in the Southeast and Northeast, in parts of the country where it's not legal, they're driving to Colorado, to Washington State, to Oregon and to California. They're getting large quantities of marijuana and marijuana products, bringing them back to the Southeast and reselling them for the cartels, including, in some cases, for legal farm operations that have an overabundance of supply. They're selling them on the black market as well, and they're funding a drug trade into the Southeast. And you're funneling through states. Nebraska is having a major problem with people transporting drugs from Colorado through Nebraska, headed into the Southeast corridor, particularly Florida, now that Florida has legalized marijuana for medicine and not recreation. But then Georgia, Alabama, South Carolina, Tennessee, North Carolina, Mississippi, Louisiana, Kentucky, there you're having a massive trade of black market drug products from states where it's legal funneling over. And then oftentimes along the way, the cartels, if you're not careful who you're buying from, are apparently lacing it with fentanyl and other additives to actually make it addictive. Marijuana in and of itself is not addictive, but things are added to it, particularly binders if you're smoking joints and stuff, or they're adding in narcotics that make it addictive. And when I read this story and the guy had somebody from California, the body of somebody from California, the body of somebody from Kansas had been arrested multiple times in the past with massive amounts of marijuana, including this one time he had how many? Where's the story? Let me pull back up the story. He was arrested. There was a drug sale when he was in college he was doing, and then he was arrested with drugs in the Atlanta airport, and then 44 marijuana joints in 2000 and 2020, and in Indiana, there were drugs involved with a high-speed chase, it appears. It just makes you wonder the ramifications and fallout of this. And also, again, why wasn't he stopped? And as Robin Walensky pointed out, who helped him escape? Who helped him? Who picked him up? Maybe they didn't know what he had done. But given the location of where the crime happened, someone had to pick this guy up. So there are still a lot of unanswered questions, and the police have been very, very hush-hush along the way. We'll see where it pans out. The phone number is 877-97-ERIC, 877-973-7425. The little sounder says the recipes, yes. Deep dish chocolate chip cookie on Wednesday. Oh, my gosh. It's still kind of raw in the center, and you put ice cream on top. It's like a souffle. Made it last night. Delicious. Trial run for the recipe. It'll be good. Text the word recipe to 33777. You get a link back. You click it. You go to the website, put in your email address. You don't get ads. You don't get spam. You just get a recipe once a week. And you can always go to ewerickson.com. There's a recipe tab. You can get all the recipes there. I will get into critical theory. I got some other stuff I want to talk about. But right now, I want to spend just a moment. This one's personal to me. Edwin Edwards has died. Edwin Edwards, if you don't know who he is, was the only four-time governor in the state of Louisiana. And Louisiana politics is different from politics wherever you live. Louisiana still has the Napoleonic Code. It doesn't use common law. You can't go to law school somewhere else and then get into Louisiana very easily without a lot of preparation to do so. It's a very, very unique state. French and English are the common tongue. They're the legal language. The constitution of the state is in French and English. It is a very interesting state. It is my native state. I grew up in Dubai, but we'd go home during the summer to Louisiana, where my mom was from, where my grandparents lived, and then ultimately we moved back there when I was in 10th grade, did 10th, 11th, and 12th grade, and then moved to Georgia, went to Mercer University, and stayed. I might have stayed in Louisiana, but for the election between David Duke and Edwin Edwards. The Edwards-Duke race was one to write. I mean, lots of books have come up about this. David Duke, if you can't recall, this was the 1991 gubernatorial election. We had just moved back from Dubai. And Edwin Edwards won 61% to David Duke's 38%. And David Duke had a showing in a Senate race. When was it? It was the 1990 campaign for the U.S. Senate. And of all things, George H.W. Bush, President of the United States of America, campaigned for J. Bennett Johnston, the Democratic senator from Louisiana. It became a very big deal, actually, and the a lot of Republicans came out and supported J. Bennett Johnston. John Danforth, Republican of Missouri. David Durenberger, Republican from Minnesota. Nancy Kassenbaum, Republican from Kansas. Frank Murkowski, Republican from Alaska. Warren Rudman, Republican from New Hampshire. Ted Stevens, Republican from Alaska. In fact, George H.W. Bush came down to Louisiana, would not stump for J. Bennett Johnston per se, but remarked kindly on him and also condemned David Duke's racism. It was just a, it was a fascinating dynamic in that race, and Duke lost barely. It was 54-43, and he presumed he would then be able to run against Edwin Edwards, and a lot of Republicans in the state of Louisiana put bumper stickers on their cars, including some members of my family, that said, "Vote for the crook. It's important." He was a David Duke, of course, notorious racist, and Edwin Edwards, a notorious crook. And people in Louisiana had to make very tough calls over who they were going to support. They wound up supporting Edwin Edwards. Edwin Edwards stacked the Louisiana Supreme Court. Louisiana's constitution banned gambling because when the state capitol had been in New Orleans, the state legislature could rarely get a quorum because the legislature was always in the casinos and the brothels. So they moved the capitol to Baton Rouge and banned gambling. Edwards packed the Louisiana Supreme Court with a bunch of people who declared that gaming was not gambling. And so they legalized gambling by calling it gaming with Edwin Edwards, members of the Louisiana Supreme Court. Fascinating guy. He has passed away this morning. The longest serving governor of Louisiana, a crook who went to jail and everybody loved him. You know what you're going to love? The Omaha Steaks Summer Grill Pack. It is back. It is better than ever. And they've got an interesting twist for you now. They've got filet mignons turned into burgers. You can get 28 Omaha Steak entrees with 8 free filet mignon burgers, an incredible value. Now, not only that, you get some of my favorites, specially packaged for you guys here. You get bacon wrapped filets. You get their boneless chicken breast. The pork chops that are delicious, the gourmet jumbo franks, my wife's personal favorite, the caramel apple tartlets, and you get those 8 free filet mignon burgers. You get bacon wrapped filets and burgers made out of filets. How do you do it? 59% savings. You go to omahasteaks.com. You use keyword Eric, E-R-I-C-K, in the search bar. You order the Summer Grill Pack, and you'll get those 8 free filet mignon burgers. They did it with the New York strips. Now they're doing it with the filets. Go to omahasteaks.com. Use Eric in the search bar. Get the Summer Grill Pack for good eats.